Hi, everyone, and welcome to Focus Forward, an executive function podcast where we explore the challenges and celebrate the wins you'll experience as you change your life through working on improving your executive function skills. I'm your host, Hannah Choi. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to give you a quick and exciting update about our coaching program. You already know that Beyond Booksmart offers one-on-one executive function coaching, helping with time management, organization, focus, you know, all those challenges we talk about here on Focus Forward. Well, we recently made some changes to make it even more flexible and affordable. Now, instead of 4 sessions a month, which can feel like a lot at times, the standard one-on-one coaching package is a subscription of 2 45-minute sessions. This allows you more flexibility because you can just do the 2 sessions if you're feeling on your game, or add more time with your coach whenever you need that extra support. It's totally up to you. And the best news, we are running a New Year's special, and you can lock in a lifetime monthly coaching subscription price of only $252 if you enroll before January 5th, 2025. Same amazing coaching, just more customizable to fit your life. If this feels like the kind of support that you or someone you know could really use, check out the show notes for more details. You can sign up on our website, beyondbooksmart.com. Or if you have questions that you want me to answer, you can shoot me an email at podcast@beyondbooksmart.com. All right. So something I love about executive function skills is that when you host a podcast all about them, you will literally never run out of topics because EF skills impact every single aspect of our lives. In today's episode, we are talking about romantic relationships and executive functioning. I am joined by Dr. David Helfand, a licensed psychologist that specializes in neurofeedback and couples therapy. Dr. H, as he goes by with his patients, shared how executive functioning impacts relationships, particularly for couples navigating the impact of stress, trauma, and neurodivergence. I was so happy to also be joined by my podcast team, Sean Potts, our editor and producer, and Justice Abbott, our creative visionary, stopped by. We got to dig deep into how to make our relationships healthier by improving our communication, emotional regulation, and intimacy. Whether you're looking to strengthen your relationship or support a partner with executive function challenges, this episode is packed full of insights to help you move forward together. And just a note, if you're listening with children around, we briefly and non-graphically mentioned sex, as this is often an important aspect of romantic relationships. Some of the questions we covered today were submitted by our listeners, and if you want to be part of the conversation, be sure to sign up for our subscriber newsletter and follow Beyond Booksmart on our social media channels. You can find links to all of those in the show notes. Okay, let's get on with the show. Hey, David. Thanks so much for joining me on Focus Forward.
Thanks for the invite, Hannah. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, me too. I've been wanting to talk about couples and executive functioning for a long time. So thank you for being here. Will you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are?
Absolutely. So formally, I'm Dr. David Helfand. I'm happy to go by David. I used to work with a lot of people that had TBIs, concussions, executive functioning. So I shortened it to Dr. H professionally for people to make it a little bit easier as well. But I'm a licensed psychologist. I practice out of Vermont in my office in St. Johnsbury. I was trained in health psychology. I did a lot of work in neurofeedback and the neuroscience side. And then at some point in my career, I realized that the systems perspective and bringing in the relationship, the family, the couples, the marriage, that whole package, I found that to be absolutely necessary. And if we have time, I'll talk about the case where that really hit home for me, if we have time to talk about that.
Yeah, but that'd be great.
My parents have run a successful couples retreat center for 30 plus years, and they were heading towards retirement. So I thought, hey, let me continue the legacy. And it's been a lot of fun the last several years doing so.
That's very cool. And what listeners cannot see is that I am super excited. I also have Sean Potts and Justice Abbott, who, if you are a longtime listener of Focus Forward, you know that they are my partners in crime here at the podcast, and they are going to be joining us later after David and I have a conversation about the impact of executive functioning and dysfunctioning on relationships. So What was I gonna say? Shoot, there was something I wanted to say. I don't remember. This is my problem. So, all right. So, I want to ask, I have a burning question that I just want to jump in and ask because I'm going to be a little selfish here, I guess. But my main enemy in life is my memory. It causes a lot of problems in my life. I have a lot of strategies that I use to improve that. Getting diagnosed with ADHD and taking meds and learning what strategies work for me has really helped a lot, but it still impacts me negatively. And it also impacts my relationship. I cannot be the only person out there that has a poor memory. And so, is this something that you see a lot? And is there anything that can that's good that can be that can come out of having a poor memory?
Yeah, so well, there's actually several answers to that, and I
Okay.
know we only have an hour, and you probably have more than one question, so I'm going to
Do.
try to make it more succinct here. First, your listeners will probably pretty quickly realize that I have some biases. One of my biases is to get to the root cause of issues, and sometimes that requires some testing. Memory is a very complex structure in your brain and complex system in your brain, rather, and it can be impacted for a number of different reasons. One of my other biases is looking at the neuroscience. I'm a huge proponent of neurofeedback and brain mapping, and so I just want to get that out up front so people understand
Cool.
where I'm coming from. So when you mention memory, there's a few things that come to my mind. First of all, attention is absolutely crucial to properly encode data into your memory to then be able to access later. So, one of the things I'm thinking of is, okay, well, is there an issue with your anterior cingulate and attention networks? That could be a traumatic brain injury, that could be sleep deprivation, that could be too much carbohydrates and you're just crashing your frontal lobe. It could be all of the above. And then there's also more temporal lobe phenomenon, which is kind of sequencing and can you follow the steps of something? I've had somebody say, well, I just want my spouse to plan a date night, but like they literally can't plan a date night because there's steps that go into that. And it's hard to kind of think through that. And then the other one that I think is also should be noted and is a little more complex is personality. Some people are just not planners. Some people, they're not interested in their spouse's career, although they're interested in their spouse. And so it's kind of unreasonable for you to be expected to remember all the details when someone's talking about, if they're a mechanical engineer and they just fixed this chipboard for a big IBM client or something. And if you're like, I have no reference to that knowledge base and I don't honestly really care about chips, microchips, then it's reasonable to say, I'm not going to remember everything you told me. So there's a lot in there that I think is important to understand and how it affects the relationship. And I think one of the things you're getting at too, because we talked about this in a quick check-in before our interview here, is the importance of forgetting in relationships. So for people that are interested in looking more into this, there's a 60-minute special. There's a couple of them now that touch on people with superior autobiographical memory. They remember every moment of their lives. If you said December 4th, 1971, they would go, oh, it was cloudy. And in the morning, I dropped the kids at school. And then I went to have lunch with Rhonda. And then we met our friend Jeff. And they were out of his favorite pudding. So we had to go to this other cafe and blah, 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 blah. And so that group has two things in common in the research. One is that they all had OCD. And if you understand how memory
Wow.
works,
Yeah.
you understand memory, actually, the OCD makes a lot of sense because they're
Yeah, it
just going
does.
over and over and over
Right.
the memories, which encodes it even further. But the other thing they have in common is 90 plus percent of them had been divorced.
Oh.
And the reason this is such an important statistic is that people that fight with their spouse often try to get to the truth of something. Well, you didn't say that, you said this, or I didn't do that, I did this, or I did this because you did this, or whatever it is. If the truth mattered in a significant way, that group of people would have a superpower because they have great memory. But it was the opposite. They'd been divorced at a higher rate than the average population. And it's because, Hannah, we don't relate to people based on facts and figures. We relate to people when we get into relationships with people, usually because you have a feeling.
Yeah,
Someone
right.
walks into the room and you go, ooh, I got the tingles and I want to get to know you more. And maybe that's a nice PG way of saying it. And so and the area of your brain that processes emotion is totally separate from areas that have rational thinking and are factually based. Although there's overlap, of course, but they're generally very separate. So forgetting actually is a useful process. And I mean, think about the people that have wronged you. If you held a grudge, which is basically not forgetting, if you held a grudge against everything that ever happened in your life, like you'd have no friends. I would have no friends if I did that.
How do people's brains and brain differences impact relationships? Maybe the most common things that are challenging for people. And then what can we do about it? Because there are brains. It's not like we can get a new brain.
There are so many different ways that people's neurology play off each other and impact a relationship. You know, I like to, when I work with a couple, I always tell them that the relationship and the marriage is my client. And a relationship is a dynamic created between and by both people. And so everything that's been imprinted in your brain, all of your developmental history, all of your events in life that shape you, your personality, all of that, comes into play in a relationship. And that includes all your baggage too. And so one of the most common ways that I see this play out is trauma. People that have trauma have generally a much more sensitive fight or flight response, which, by the way, for your listeners, the I'm going to say fight or flight as a simple measure. It is fight, flight, freeze, fawn, fib, tend, and befriend. So it's
Ooh,
a
I
much
didn't have the
larger
last three.
response. I'm going to use fight or flight though as just a simplicity, a simple version of that. So, you know, what happens with trauma is especially developmental childhood trauma is that, imagine these big trees that grow in the woods that get to be, 100, 200, 500 years old, whatever it might be. If they live through some natural disaster, at some point you could see a blemish in the rings at the time of that disaster. Right? It's kind of stored in the tree's trunk. Your nervous system works the same way, that if you have a trauma at a certain stage of development, it's kind of held in those areas that are developing. And that's why developmental trauma is so particularly challenging for people, because if it's an adult trauma and you had a pretty good childhood, you generally have more resiliency. But if it's while you're developing, it can really derail quite a lot. And so what happens is in relationships, somebody might say or do something that triggers your fight or flight response. Remember, fight, flight, et cetera, but triggers your fight or flight response. And it's not intentionally to piss you off or to hurt you. I call them landmines. You know, you're having a relationship, someone steps on a landmine, and then you're like, oh my God, how did we get here? But it's someone's reaction. So, you know, a quick example of that is you mentioned your memory earlier. And so let's imagine that the two of you are, you and your partner are wake up in the morning and they say, I'm really excited for today. And you go, oh my God, what's today? Right? And it's the fourth anniversary of the first time you saw each other, right? Which is not something everyone tends to remember. I'm speaking from some experience here too. And so, not remembering what feels like an important date for your partner might feel like dismissive. They might feel unimportant. And chances are, if they have some trauma, that has a theme. We call it the 90-10 in psychology, that 90% of the reason you have a strong emotion is based on historical baggage and stuff you've been through. So the 10% is that, okay, I forgot what the date was. But the reason that's significant is the 90%. And so part of what I do in couples therapy is to help people, okay, when you step on that landmine, then what do? How do you talk about, hey, this is significant for this reason? And you just stepped on the landmine. It's not really your fault, but like, here's what's going on for me. And the cool part about that is when you learn how to communicate in that way, you actually dissociate the stress, the trauma, the anxiety, the unpleasant emotions, you dissociate that from the relationship. Now the two of you are talking about this thing and you're looking at solving it together rather than you stepped on my landmine, you wronged me, you pissed me off, whatever. It's, hey, my old baggage got triggered.
It's so funny because this that kind of happened this morning. My husband usually brings, or my husband brings the kids to school every day, and he had a doctor's appointment early this morning, so he was going to leave. And I said to him, "Oh, I think I'll take our son to school because I have somewhere to be right after that." And he was like, "Okay." And then I was like, "Wait, you're not even going to be here. Of course I'm taking him to school. You're not even going to be here." But luckily he was just like, "Okay."
Yeah,
It didn't trigger anything.
so
He's used to me not remembering stuff like that.
you might have had some memory that jostled, like, I should probably
Yeah.
take my son to school today.
Yeah. Yeah, there was something there. Yeah. It's right there. I'm talking about you, Eric. How I forgot that you had to be out somewhere today. See, he just laughed.
So, and it's, laughing is a is one of the things that I'm just noticing in the shorter interaction is the playfulness. I find that so many couples take these things so seriously.
Oh,
And
yeah.
sometimes it is serious. Like, sometimes there are issues that, need to be addressed in a serious manner. But if you can find a sense of playfulness with it really goes a long way. And again, there are times to take it serious, but if you can kind of laugh at yourself, laugh at each other in a way that feels compassionate and loving, it makes a big difference.
That's so true because we did laugh about it now and this morning, and that is so important because if we hadn't, all I would have felt w was bad that I had forgotten. But it wasn't like I did it intentionally. I just wasn't paying attention to what day it was. Yeah.
So, I mean, again, neurologically, one of my biases is the neuroscience.
Yeah, go there. I love it.
I will often tell couples, so I'll just share this real quick. I had a couple come in and see me, and he was a old school engineer. He was in his 80s, really nice guy. And I went through this whole curriculum of, like, here's how you talk to each other and share emotions. And, like, this whole thing was like 35 minutes long. And at the end, I always say, like, okay, you have any questions or feedback or anything that I, need to clarify? And he just looks at me and he goes, "What?" I was like, okay. So I said, here's what it boils down to. And I've used this now for years because I found it really helpful, and he found it really helpful. When you interact with your spouse, you should have more happy hormones than stress hormones. That's the bottom line. Laughter is one of those ways to create happy hormones. Am I allowed to go PG-13 on this podcast? So orgasms are another way to create happy hormones. You're probably going to laugh more than you do the former, but in general, that's what keeps couples together. And so the playfulness, the humility, that's really important. If he were to say, "Listen, I can't believe you're doing this again. You clearly, I'm not important. You don't remember my schedule." That's where the stress hormones take over, and then, you need some strategies to get through that.
So you mentioned intimacy. Like, how does that play into healthy relationships, especially in relationships where there is, some neurodivergence? Does that do, is there some interplay there?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I find in general there are four pillars that make up a really fulfilling, successful relationship or marriage. And these have been pretty well researched. I haven't seen these four in a research article. Maybe that'll be my next publication. As a matter of fact, that'll be in the book coming out at some point next year, hopefully.
Let's talk about that.
But basically, it's communication. You need to have good communication with your partner. You need to have regulation, that's personal regulation, emotional regulation, and also co-regulation, the way you do that together. Prioritization. So prioritization is, do I feel like I'm a priority to you? Am I expressing and showing that you're a priority to me? And then the last one is intimacy. And intimacy is emotional, physical, sexual, and sometimes spiritual for people. Sometimes sharing your faith with your partner is a real sense of a vulnerable kind of intimacy that's very meaningful. And you might not share that with a lot of other people, especially if it feels like the communities around you shun that, and your relationship is a place to express it. So when you ask about intimacy, yeah, absolutely. And I know that, part of what we're trying to accomplish in our conversation here is how this relates to neurodivergence. So let's talk a little bit about that. neurodivergence is such a broad topic. It's like using the word anxiety. Anxiety is such a broad umbrella these days.
Yeah, it really
And
is.
so, whether you're somewhere on the spectrum, whether you have ADHD, whether you have insomnia that then leads to these other kinds of symptoms, or you have a TBI that then looks like neurodivergence. I mean, there's really so many reasons for these symptoms or diagnoses or
Or you
labels.
have, yeah, like a super stressful job, or,
Yeah, or you have three jobs, you know, and you're pulled in all these directions,
And
or you
still
have
not
three
making enough
kids.
money.
Right. So, I mean, all these can look like somewhere on that grander spectrum. And, you know, the what I find is that it's really important to define intimacy as a couple. Some couples need a healthy sex life, and there's a lot of research that sexual intimacy is a very important prognostic indicator for overall relationship satisfaction. And there's a lot of people that have a stressful life, but then their sex life is a way that they get those happy hormones and kind of stay regulated. And that's really helpful, really important. And if you have a partner that you can do that with, that's fantastic. Other people, it doesn't feel as important. And what I'm noticing more and more is that couples in the neurodivergent world see sex as very different. Sometimes sex for them is extremely stressful. You know, the performance anxiety comes up, or the like, there might be some embarrassment about, you know, how they find pleasure in their body or their partner's body. They might be embarrassed about their fetishes or fantasies. And so for some people, sexual intimacy and emotional intimacy is just having a partner where you can talk about fantasies. Or for some people, they might say, listen, I just want like a back massage or a back scratch, or can I just hug you and kiss you? You know, and for some people, that feels really, really intimate and scary. And this is again where trauma comes into play. If you have especially sexual trauma, there's a whole other conversation to be had there about how you deal with that. I'll just say really quickly, I really like Peggy Klein-Platz's work on sexual trauma. She's very prolific in the field. And a lot of what she says boils down to the spouse's job is to create the opposite emotional experience of the other spouse's trauma. So if someone has a trauma where they felt out of control, they felt belittled, they felt less than, your job as the spouse is to prop them up and give them control, let them feel safe, the opposite of whatever their traumatic experience was. I find that really powerful with couples. And even, you know, as a personal therapy, I think it could work too. So getting back to your original question, I tend to have long-winded answers. I have a lot to say. I think defining it is a really important and crucial first step.
It sounds like it comes down to communication, which is, I mean, like you said, one of the other pillars, it's so important. I mean, I think you said that. It's so important to to whatever you're communicating about, whatever it is the issue is, whatever the topic is in your relationship, be able to communicate it, which can be really difficult for someone who is experiencing some kind of executive dysfunction. Maybe they, are just experiencing difficulty communicating, sharing their feelings.
Absolutely. And I often recommend meta communication as a good start. So meta communicating means to talk about talking. And sometimes that can be a really important first step. So let's say that the last time you were with your partner, you just felt kind of uncomfortable. Maybe you were kissing, maybe you were going further than that, but like there was just something that kind of felt a little uncomfortable. You felt pressured, you felt self-conscious, you weren't doing it well, whatever it is. So you could say to your partner something like, you know, the last time that we were intimate or on our date last week or, you know, whatever, I felt a lot of anxiety and I felt kind of embarrassed or unsure of myself, or I felt something really uncomfortable and I don't really know what to call it. And so I really want to think more about that, and maybe in a future check-in or conversation, I use the word check-ins with my couples, but in a future conversation, I want to kind of explore that with you and figure that
So
out.
it gives them some space to think about it. They don't have to, they're not, you're not putting them on the spot to talk about it right then.
Right. And what you're doing is you're letting them know that there's something going on here. And, you know, that's really important. Notice that also what I'm doing is I'm sharing what I want. That's like the most important pillar of couples communication. You want to share what you want, not what you don't want. You know, the metaphor I usually use is Have you ever used a GPS that told you not to turn right somewhere? Probably not. So if you want to get to a destination, you need to say how to get there. And I want to have a conversation. I want to figure this out. These are really affirmative statements, as opposed to I don't want to be anxious anymore. I don't want to feel insecure. Some people call that good communication, but it's really not.
You said it's the spouse's job to help them feel to experience the opposite of what they're feeling or of what they experienced. And it made me think of these questions that people asked us to ask you. What role do partners play in supporting their partner who has some kind of executive function challenges? What role do they play in supporting that without feeling like a parent, or maybe without enabling this, maybe some kind of behavior that isn't so great? How can couples find that healthy balance?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think every couple is going to have a slightly different formula. So it's hard for me to answer that in a general way, but I can give you some kind of examples that I think narrow it down. So the question about, not becoming an enabler, I think is really astute of whoever asked that. We have a tendency in our culture we want the people around us to feel good. And we take it as a personal reflection if the people around us don't feel good. And so we could talk for a while about projection and displacement in psychology, but just generally speaking, we want people to feel good. And so I think we see this with parenting. I think we see this with relationships a lot, where people take a very heavy hand in trying to help the people around them get to a good place. And, what we know from the science is that there's a fine line between offering support and empathy and your assistance and then enabling so that the other person doesn't have to do the work to help themselves. So, what I usually recommend is starting off with meta communication. Figure out where you want to go, how you're feeling, what's going on, and figure out what the end goal is first. So, you might say something like, well, let's use the topic we were talking about earlier. So role playing as your husband for a moment, Hannah. I might say something like, listen, one of the things I really want in our marriage is to feel like we're a team. When we're both in this together and I feel support by you and I'm able to support you and your dreams and goals, that makes me more attracted to you. That makes me feel like, damn, we really got this. And it's just like the flow, the team, really, it's just amazing. It really is amazing. And part of that for me is you helping me maintain the family schedule. And so I feel really stuck. That I know you have some concerns with executive functioning, and that there's times where I want to like remind you the day before, hey, remember tomorrow morning is this thing. And that feels weird to me because sometimes I think that you're mad at me if I do that. Sometimes I think that I have to do it to get what I want. And realistically, I'd like to find a way for that just to flow really well. And I just want to talk about that. So again, notice what I'm doing is this is what I want. This is what I'm looking for. I'm sharing a little bit of like, this is some of my frustration, but the majority of what I'm saying is painting a picture and describing where I want to take this relationship. And by the way, the like, what it means to the marriage as well, to then do that with you. So that's how I would open the conversation. And then this is where the particulars become really important. If your executive functioning is partly because you're sleep deprived, well, then we need to like back it up and figure that out, right? If you're the one waking up with the baby every morning, maybe I need to pitch in and wake up with the baby to then for me to be able to get what I want. And I certainly wouldn't call that enabling if that's the case. And then, the me reminding you the day before, that's where it starts to feel more like enabling, that I'm playing the role of your memory. And so figuring out another way to do that is helpful. Maybe setting an alarm on your phone every night, just at 6 o'clock every evening, you look at the calendar the next day. Maybe that's a solution.
The irony of this, now that I think about it, is we started doing family meetings so that this wouldn't happen. And Eric and I had this conversation standing next to the family calendar. So it's so cool when you talk about all that stuff because I just keep thinking of all the executive function skills that are attached to all that and being able to do like that meta communication is really meta is metacognition, being able to understand what works for you, what doesn't work for you, and then prioritizing. Like, can we prioritize ourselves? Can we prioritize our relationship? And then planning ahead, like you have to plan. You can't just launch this onto your partner. You have to think, okay, like when is going to be the best time to do this? And so if you struggle with impulse control, you might just, like throw this thing at your partner and then they're like, ah, what? I'm not ready for that. So they're really, I can see how struggles with executive functioning would really impact your relationship without you even realizing it.
Yeah. Well, and part of what you talked about before is your husband knows you at this point, right?
Yeah.
And so coming back to one of our previous points here is that the accepting your partner's personality is also important. And again, there's a fine line. How much do I accept and how much do I push back and say, no, I really want to change this? And I hear this phrase a lot where people say, well, you shouldn't change your spouse. You shouldn't want to change your spouse. And BS, if you ask me. I mean, everyone's always changing. We're always growing. And couples certainly change each other for the worse if they're fighting constantly. So
Yeah, right.
shouldn't you want to change each other for the better? And,
Yeah. I mean, that's part of what we say, like, oh, I like this person because he helps me or they help me become like a better version of myself or something.
right.
Yeah.
And if you got married in your 20s, I sure hope you're going to change as you get to your 30s, 40s, 50s, and so on.
Well, oh my gosh, that is a perfect transition because I was just thinking of asking Justice and Sean to join us. And Justice is getting married in March
Hey,
and she's in
congratulations.
her 20s. So, hello, Justice and Sean. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, this is very different to be here on the front side of the podcast. It's fun.
Yeah, cool. Hi, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a bit.
Yeah. Sean, I also was just thinking about you because so David, Sean has been in a long-term relationship. He's been with the same partner for many years, like what, like 9 years or something?
Yeah, 9 years as of this month.
Yeah. So, and you're also, he's also in his 20s, late 20s, getting up
Wow.
there. So, Sean and Justice, do you guys have any questions for Dr. H for David, based on what we were just talking about, or anything that you wanted to bring into the conversation?
Yeah, I have lots. I was like listening very intently. I was texting Sean like during, I was like, this is really interesting. Like for me personally, I love it. Like I want him as my therapist. But one of the questions that came up when you were talking about, like when you guys first started talking about expectations in relationships, that like really stood out to me because I feel like I'm someone who has very high expectations for not just romantic relationships, but just everybody in my life, like friends, family. I feel like I hold everybody to the same expectations that I hold myself to. And so I'm wondering, like, what tips do you have to kind of try to help people get better executive function skills without sounding like I'm controlling or I'm overbearing or like I'm just like that annoying friend that's like, why are you late? You need to like do better. We agree we're gonna meet at this time, or like just like feel like I'm nagging because I want people to just be better.
Yeah. So, well, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I wonder what your brain looks like, maybe a little OCD perfectionism somewhere in there.
Oh, yeah. I was diagnosed with OCD and anxiety 2 years ago.
So, one of the things we know about OCD and also ADHD, there's quite a lot of overlap with those two because they both impact the anterior cingulate usually. And what happens is you can get stuck then, you can ruminate. And so what I often tell people is it's helpful in relationships to distinguish my stuff and your stuff and our stuff. And so if there's a my stuff moment, you can just say, this is my stuff, right? I'm ruminating because you were 5 minutes late. I know that it doesn't matter, but I'm still stuck on it. And I wish I could just get that off out of my brain. And just saying it, getting it out there can be really helpful. Notice though, the difference is I'm presenting my anxiety and my rumination, but I'm also fixing it for them. And that's a big difference. If I say, hey, you're late and I'm upset, period, Now I'm putting my anxiety on my partner or my friend, and that's not fair. That's where then they have to fix me, and that's not a good recipe. So I'm upset, I'm frustrated, and I also realize that this is not a big deal realistically, and I'm working through it. You know, that kind of it creates that line now where I'm owning it, I'm getting it out there, but I'm also working through it in real time. So that would be one thing. There's a lot of cognitive behavioral techniques. I don't know if we wanted to go through like a curriculum in this podcast, but you know, CBT has a lot of like thought logs, automatic thought logs, intrusive thoughts. You know, how do you kind of work through those? You can look those up online. There's certainly a whole lot of curriculums out there for that. Or for anyone that, you know, is working with a CBT therapist, tell them you want to do a thought log. That's like a classic CBT technique. And again, the nice part about having the thought log worked out is you can then come to your friends or your partner and say, hey, I'm having this automatic thought and this issue, but I've worked on it. And hey, look, here's what happened. You know, the worst thing, I mean, I guess this isn't technically the worst thing, but one of the bad things that someone could do though is just keep that all internal and try to work through it in your head. Your brain and your mind are a very ethereal place. And have, you guys know the expression, sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Ooh,
I like
So, you know,
that.
if you have an old pair of gym shoes or a, you know, stinky shorts or shirt you just, you know, ran in, put it out on a sunny day, the UV rays kill the bacteria and, you know, it'll be pretty good moving forward. You might still want to throw it in the wash, but generally speaking, the UV rays do quite a lot. Your emotions work the same way. So when you're dealing with an emotional situation, to keep all of that inside actually festers and creates a lot more issues. If you can get it out in the right way, it does start to detox it from your mind body experience, however you want to think of it. You know, I think we take our thoughts too personal. Your brain is an electrical chemical machine
Yeah,
processor, and
right.
electricity follows the path of least resistance. So if you've had anxiety, it's going to go down that path and you're going to have some more anxiety. And it's funny because it's the only thing we really, it's the only biological process we identify with so significantly. If you broke your leg, would you go around telling people, I am broken? That sounds kind of crazy, right?
Yeah.
But when you have an anxious thought, you have a depressed thought, you have an insecure thought, you say, I am anxious, I am depressed, I am insecure. And we identify too much with our thoughts. They're largely just chaos. It's just stuff going through your brain that you're like, oh, that's me. But it's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think when you have had the life experience of, like, say you have ADHD, you, I'm giving that example because it's my personal lens, but you have received these messages throughout your whole life that you start to believe that this stuff might actually be true. Like these thoughts that you're having in your head, maybe that is true. And so it makes it harder to air them because, ooh, if I say it out loud, maybe it's even doubly true. It's just harder. It's harder to ignore them when you feel like you're also getting that message from outside.
Because yeah, I also have ADHD, and like I've definitely been able to successfully navigate having it in my 9-year relationship with my girlfriend. But I feel like we're always both trying to improve the way like we communicate and like navigate some of those tension points, like especially the ones that stem from my ADHD. So do you have like any tips for navigating conflict resolution when ADHD is a factor for one of the partners?
You happen to step on a landmine, and here we are. So if you're having an emotional reaction, own it. This is my reaction, my shit to deal with, my baggage, right? And then what you can do is you can make your partner an ally in fixing it. And sometimes it's, I really need a hug right now, right? Just like, let's just start there. And if that works for the two of you, great. You know, some people don't want physical contact if they're feeling sort of, conflictual. So, you know, that's going to vary by partner, but you might have to start there. You know, one of the things I recommend for couples is to have scheduled check-ins through the week after people see me. Most couples come to see me when they're on the edge of divorce. So they're going to be having a lot of check-ins to try to repair and fix things. If your relationship's doing reasonably well, you might have one or two check-ins a week. And the nice thing about having a scheduled check-in is you want to block about a half an hour. And you might only use 5 minutes, but you want to block off about a half an hour. And you're checking in with each other. You know, I'm curious how you're feeling, or there's been something I've been ruminating on, and I kind of want to clear the air here. Having that scheduled and knowing that's coming can sometimes already decrease the conflict. There's no good time to deal with conflict. And so sometimes when it's in the moment, people feel this urgency to like fix it. But if you or your partner are already emotionally overwhelmed, what's going on is your limbic system is taking over control of your brain. And especially if you already have executive functioning issues, your frontal lobe is already at a disadvantage. And once your limbic system is involved, forget about it. So that fight or flight response, your fight or flight response is designed to deal with a wild animal who's about to hurt you or kill you. If you're perceiving your partner as a wild animal who's about to hurt you or kill you, that's not going to go well in a conversation. So
No.
you need to get back into your frontal lobe as best as possible, and having that scheduled check-in or having a moment to say, listen, I'm really agitated by what you just said, and I need a moment to cool down, and then I want to come back and process that. You know, giving yourself that time is a very important, crucial step. And then obviously, I have specific communication skills that I teach and other ways to then follow up, but that would be the kind of the first step.
We call that
And
HALT in coaching. It's like the hungry, angry, lonely, tired. If it's any of the four, and it's something that could be conflict driven or like is a stressor, maybe wait to bring it up.
The other thing that helps is curiosity. Curiosity goes a really long way in relationships. So let's say that your partner is furious about something. So they're in that fight or flight response, right? They think you're the wild animal. If you say, I think I stepped on a landmine. I really didn't mean to, but I'd like to try to help if we can talk about it right now. I mean, imagine there's a lion in the wild who's like growling and snarling at you, and then you freak out, and then the lion goes, you look upset. Can we talk about this? Your nervous system's going to go, I don't think they're a threat anymore. This feels a little bit different. Now, obviously, there's caveats. If you've been manipulated in past relationships, if you have trauma, that's a whole other category. But generally speaking, curiosity goes, authentic, genuine curiosity goes a really long way to tamping down that fight or flight and then opening up a meaningful dialogue.
Something that you mentioned before is, going back to the root cause, and are people overtired, or is something else going on? And it reminds me of how that you, in order to be able to be self-regulated, you really do need to address those things. And I feel like people don't give enough attention to, or enough value or weight to, moving your body and eating well and getting enough sleep. And people kind of roll their eyes when people are like, oh, well, you need to get more sleep, or you need to improve your whatever, get more exercise. But it's so true. I mean, you must see that all the time in your practice.
Yeah. I mean, I have a couple where a ham sandwich after work saved their marriage. he would come home and, they would get into an argument because she wanted to like go over kind of a schedule and figure things out. And he was just waiting for dinner. And so, I said, can you just pack a ham sandwich in your car and like eat it on the drive or when you get home and then get into the family life? And they were like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Actually a really good
You know,
idea.
to your hangry point that you or hungry point that you mentioned earlier too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, again, regulation is one of the pillars of what I teach couples, and it's really important. And the trick here is, you might be familiar with the stages of change model.
Yeah, that's what we use at Beyond Booksmart, actually.
Yep. So the preparation, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, maintenance, and relapse. And the trick here is to know where each partner is in that journey and process. And so, as a professional, if somebody is very pre-contemplative, they don't see the reason for exercise, let's say, but I know that exercise will help them with their stress and get them out, then I'll try to find any avenue to get them to consider it. And if they're ready for action, how do we integrate that into your lifestyle so that, you don't have to go to the gym 3 times a week? Because that's not necessary for most people. It's great if that's your routine, but a lot of people don't want to go to the gym 3 times a week. And Can you, and ideally, again, the marriage is my client when I'm working with couples or the relationship. And so, can you bring your partner into it? Can the two of you go walk the dog? Can you get a stroller that fits all the kids and you just go for a walk before dinner or after dinner? Just building in some lifestyle routines makes a big difference.
That also address those kind of basic needs that
Right.
we need
I'm a
to.
huge
Yeah.
fan of double and triple dipping. If you can get multiple benefits from something, do it.
Nice.
So, David,
Yeah.
would you say that most of the issues you see with romantic relationships stem from neurodiversities or mental health challenges? Like, is that often at the root of whatever's going on?
So in some ways you could say that I really think the issue is no one's ever taught how to be married. I mean, think of all the accomplishments you've had in life is probably because you had some kind of skill set to do so. Maybe like minus T-ball, back in the day, but but generally speaking, carpenters go to school or they have an apprenticeship, doctors get training, CPAs get training. You're all executive functioning coaches or in that world somehow, and you probably had training in how to do that. So there's training, and the divorce rate's about 50%, give or take in any year, because no one's ever taught how to do this, in my opinion. And so I think the skills are the first thing, that you have to learn the skills of marriage to expect to have a good marriage. That's like first and foremost. Now, after you have the skills, applying them correctly and knowing kind of how to navigate your marriage in particular, a lot of that then comes down to mental health. Yeah. So trauma is the biggest one that I see. People that have trauma often it wreaks so much havoc in their relationship. The other thing that comes up a lot is reasonable expectations. So one of the things that I have couples do is make a kind of describe your ideal marriage. I have a specific way that I do that, but essentially it's like describe your ideal marriage and then go through each of those points. Can you get a passing grade in your relationship? Because one of the reasons that second divorces have a higher rate of failure is people got divorced for the wrong reasons. And then they get into another marriage and they go, oh, I'm making the same mistakes. Or like, this is starting to feel like my other marriage. And they're just repeating a pattern. And there's probably things you'd love to take a magic wand and change you or your partner. Generally, people pick their partner. But, there's a reality to that. If you can get a passing grade, that's fantastic.
Sean, did you have any questions for him?
Well, it's a delayed follow-up question, actually, as we transitioned into Justice and I being part of the conversation. But you mentioned how one of the challenges that you try to help couples with is making sure that they can kind of grow together. Because, if you're in a long-term relationship, you're not the same person you are in the beginning as you are 10, 20, 30 years down the line. So, what kind of advice do you have to help couples ensure that they grow together rather than apart?
So the research shows that couples have to be coupled centered in order for their marriage to thrive and for them to continue growing together. Coupled centered is juxtaposed to other centered. Other centered is child centered, career centered, friends, hobbies, family of origin, and everything but couples. So if you are maintaining a coupled centered approach, you should be checking in with each other. You should be talking about life goals. You should maintain an emotional connection, oftentimes a sexual connection. And the trick is that that's really easy for most people early in the relationship. When you have
I
kids,
was just going to say, and then you have kids.
and then you have kids, when you have careers, when you have maybe a pet with medical issues, when you have a housing crisis, when there's a loss in the family, right? These things start to make it more complicated. And then also keep in mind that when you first start dating your partner, you're high on hormones. All those, like that infatuation period, just totally messes up your nervous system. One of my favorite definitions in the field is that infatuation is when you don't see the flaws in your partner. Love is when you see the flaws and choose to be with them anyway.
Cool.
I really like that
Yeah.
comparison. So now I need some executive functioning. Where are we going with that?
growing together, staying together.
Right,
Oh, couple centered, couple centered.
coupled center. Thank you, Hannah.
You're welcome. Ooh, good job.
You get assist points.
Yay.
So yeah. So couple centeredness really is, I think, the heart of the answer to your question. And you know, part of that is also being planful. You can accidentally connect with people, with your partner early on, because you know, my wife and I joke about how we would wake up at 9 o'clock and go, should we go hit the Chinese buffet? Should we go, you know, bike into Boston today? Like, you know, what should we do? Now we're, you know, woken up at 6:30 and we have no control over our schedule for the whole day. So we have to say, hey, I'd like to have a date in 2 weeks. You know, let's make a date now. Let's get a babysitter. Let's plan this out, because otherwise it won't happen.
I have heard so many so my kids are teenagers and you know most of my friends' kids are also around the same age, and I've heard so many people, including myself, when once we get to this point, say, "Oh, I'm remembering why I married my partner in the first place," because we're kind of becoming more couple-centered again, when for so long it has been kid-centered. And so, and that planning thing becomes easier because you're not planning all the time for this, the other thing that is taking you away from your relationship.
Yeah, that's
Another
very true.
executive function skill, planning.
You got a little bit lucky though, Hannah. So let's take a quick survey here. What do you think the most common time for divorce is? Years into marriage, what's the most common time for divorce?
2 years?
So, Justice, if I had a little virtual trophy we could pop up on the screen, you get a half a trophy. So it's 2 and 7. The most common time for divorce is 2 and 7 years. Now, there's an emerging trend that I think will make this trimodal maybe in a few years, that gray divorce is getting more common. When people become empty nesters, they look at each other and they go, I don't think we're gonna do this anymore. And they're making that determination. But we don't have, I'm not aware of the data on that, if that's as significant as the 2 and 7 year mark. But 2 and 7, and a lot of that has to do with kids. And the infatuation wears off in about 1 to 2 years. So then you might get married and then you look at each other and you go, well, yeah, I don't know about this anymore.
Well, my last question for Sean and I, at least, since we're both in our 20s on the verge of marriage and kids and all that, what would be your advice for people in their 20s approaching marriage and all those life stones to try to keep, that couple centricness before the kids, so that we don't, so we can be proactive and not have to get into that, beat those 2 and 7 year odds.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, maintaining that connection is so important, and being planful is really important. I would also say that a lot of couples see it as very black and white. You know, we need to go on a date. We need to have a getaway, you know, so many times. And that is absolutely crucial. I would definitely do that. But it's also very micro. You can have a lot of micro moments that manage to keep some level of intimacy and keep some connection going. So, you know, for example, my wife and I flirt with each other most days, many times. You know, I'll say, oh, the cat toy went under the sofa. Can you check? And you know, she's down there looking, and then she goes, there's no cat toy, is there? I go, nope. So, you know, stuff like that's kind of fun. The kids are screaming in the background. Sometimes we come, we make eye contact, we might hug real quick, and we go like, here we go. 30 seconds or less. You know, but just having those little micro moments make a big difference. And, you know, what I'm describing is the flow of my relationship. Other relationships are going to have a different authentic baseline. And so, whatever that baseline is for you, keeping that going. I like to think about one of the questions I have on my intake form is, describe the courtship. What did you used to do? What made you feel close? What activities were you involved in? Because a lot of that just stops. And if you can bring it back, even in a micro cosmotic way, it makes a big difference.
Oh,
And then
this
the last,
makes me feel. Oh, no. Yeah.
so I'm just going to give you one more statistic. Justice, you mind if I pick on you for a moment?
Yeah, please do.
So, how old are you?
I'll be 25 in December.
And did you go to college? So, the research on divorce is that in a heterosexual relationship, I'm making an assumption, I don't know if that's true, but in a heterosexual relationship, just generally speaking, if the woman is at least 25 with a college degree, the divorce rate is under 30%.
Good job,
So
Justice.
good for
Yeah,
you. This is one of the reasons that there's a lot of efforts in other countries to push women's education to get, degrees, at least a bachelor's degree, because it seems to help the family dynamic. It helps with the divorce rates. It helps with overall life satisfaction. It actually has quite a lot to it. So it's an exciting field if people want to look into that more.
that's
Sure,
interesting that it's just of the woman, though. Like, I'd
Yep.
love to know why.
Yeah, so I don't know the answer. I have
Yeah.
some educated guesses that I could hypothesize, but I don't know the actual answer to that question.
Yeah,
Well,
that's
things are looking
also another podcast, another
good.
conversation. I just wanted to say that it's nice to hear. I feel validated because one thing that my husband and I do is every time we walk by each other, we just like reach out and touch each other. Like, I'll just touch him on my back as on his back as I walk by, or he'll like hold his hand out and just touch my hand as he walks by. And when our kids were little, I really think that was a huge part of why we stayed together. Also, my husband was very sick like throughout our children's entire youngness, and so it was r extra stressful. And so just having that connection, I think, was probably like the only time we connected, because we were
Yeah.
just like trying to not drown.
Also, I love. Oh, sorry.
So if I
I
can add to that, Hannah, real quick, I hear from a lot of couples that that touch is really important. I also hear from a lot of moms in particular that they are touched out at the end of the day when
That's
they
true
have little
too.
kids. And so
That's true.
this is a great example where meta communicating would be helpful. If I come home from work and I go to touch you or give you a hug, and I feel you recoil, which it might just be an involuntary response because you're like, oh my God, I need some personal space, right? I'm going to take that personally. It has nothing to do with me, though. And so having that conversation, having that meta communication, like, hey, listen, when I come home, I'd really like to kind of physically reconnect. You might say, I want that too. I just need like a half hour where no one is within 20 feet
Yes.
of me.
Yes. I do remember feeling that,
Yep.
especially when I was breastfeeding my children. Like, oh God, don't touch me. But maybe
Yep.
it's just like that quick, like just a brush on my finger was okay. Yeah.
I also like the one thing I saw a video about how if you kiss for 6 seconds, you get all the benefits. Like you get all the oxytocin and a bunch of bonding neurotransmitters kind of activate. And like, so if you're leaving the house or you're going to bed or whatever those kind of things are, if you kiss for 6 seconds, like neurobiologically, there's a bonding benefit to it. And we've been doing that a bunch recently. And I do,
Nice.
you feel it. You hit the
Yeah.
6 seconds, like you can feel those chemicals go through your body. It's crazy.
Same with like a 20-second hug too.
Yep.
Yeah.
So for those of you that are interested, the hormones released are dopamine, oxytocin, and endorphins.
That's why. Those are good.
Yep, those are good hormones. Oxytocin is the bonding hormone or the hug hormone. It's released in quantities when you have an orgasm. Endorphins, if you break the word down, endogenous morphine. It's morphine created in your body, and it's actually a painkiller. It's a really happy, jovial kind of hormone. And then dopamine is part of that reward cycle, part of that, like, I want this, I want more of this, right? And that's also part of the bonding. So, and then the 6 second kiss, I believe, is John and Julie Gottman's work, which they're prolific in the field. They have a lot of good research.
They're so
So
good.
I use their stuff a lot. And yeah.
So before we go, David, will you share with our listeners all of your info, where they can find you, where they can learn more about the services that you provide, including your marriage camp? Is that what you said?
Yeah. So it's a couples therapy retreat, marriage
Hmm.
intensive. There's, so many different synonyms for it. But as I mentioned, my parents have been doing this for 30 plus years. They've been rated, depending on the websites you read, the number one couples retreat in the US. We also get international draw. People come from all over to work with us, and it's really rewarding, really fun work. And most of the couples that see us are on the edge of divorce. So we do kind of a 3 or 4 day intensive. And you're doing about a year of therapy in 3 or 4 days. It's a few hours each day to really drill down to the root and try to save you. And as we talked about before, no one's ever taught how to be married. So I always start with the same hypothesis. Your marriage can be successful and fulfilling. You'd have to learn the skills first. And so first we teach you the skills. And then, well, if you're If it's still not working once you learn the skills, then we can talk about separation or whatever you need to talk about. But first, you gotta learn
At
the
least
skills.
try.
At least try, exactly. And
So,
40% of about 40% of couples that get divorced regret it later. And in my experience, it's because they didn't give it a fair shot. They were never taught the skills. So people can learn more on the website, marriagequest.org. You can also schedule a free consultation. It's worth noting that, the services are not covered by insurance, and that, it is an investment for you to try to save your marriage. The average cost of divorce just for attorney's fees is about $15,000 in the US. I can assure you we're less than that,
That's good.
but it is still an investment if you want to, come try to save your marriage.
And then, do you have a personal website that people can go to if they want to learn more about you and your practice?
Sure. So marriagequest.org is the main website. It's also, there's an umbrella company, lifewisevt.com. And that's life like living, wise like wisdom, and then VT because I'm in Vermont.
Nice.
And just so you know, if you go to lifewise.com, that's an insurance company in Washington. That's not
Not
me.
you. Okay. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. This was super interesting, and I don't want to go. I kind of want to keep talking. So this may be a longer episode than we normally put out. But Sean and Justice, I think we made the right decision.
Well, I
All
really
right.
appreciate it. Thanks for the invite, and I'd love to come back. And for anyone listening to this, there's so many topics we could cover. Hannah, you and I were trying to figure out how to narrow it down, and I don't even know if we did narrow it down that much.
No, there's
But
so much to talk about.
if anyone wants to reach out to Hannah or the show, Beyond Booksmart, I would say send your questions, and I'd be happy to come back, and we'll go through the topics.
That'd be awesome. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen. Sean, Justice, and I had such a great time talking with Dr. Helfand, and we really hope to have him back because there is so much more to learn. We hope you learned something that you can apply today if you're in a relationship or in the future when you meet the one. Be sure to check out the show notes for more helpful information about today's topic. As always, if you have questions or topic suggestions, you can reach out to me at podcast@beyondbooksmart.com. And I'm still collecting stories about executive function wins, so please send them over to me. Again, that email address is podcast@beyondbooksmart.com. It helps us a ton if you can rate us on Apple or Spotify, or even better, leave a written review on Apple, somewhere people can find us. You can follow and even set up auto downloads of Focus Forward on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can sign up for our subscriber email at beyondbooksmart.com/podcast, and you can find our social media channels at Beyond Booksmart Coaching. We are on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you so much to Dr. Helfand for joining me, and to Sean and Justice for coming over to the other side of the podcast for an episode. Hey guys, let's do it again. It was so fun. Thanks for listening.